You create opposing forces which you place in conflict. Out of conflict, you've got profit, you've got political power, and you can direct history. And if you look at the writings, for example, of the Trilateral Commission, they talk openly in the Trilateral Commission about managing conflicts. Not solving conflicts, but managing conflicts. Conflict management.
To BCFM Politics Show with former Sunday Times journalist Kevin Carhill and me, Tony Gosling. A double whammy in Syria. An Iranian tanker full of oil heads for Syria, but he's hit by two missiles from the direction of, guess where? Saudi Arabia. And Donald Trump pulls US troops out from northern Syria. Hang on, isn't that what he promised to do 4 years ago when he was running for president? Also, the Hong Kong protests come to Bristol. We hear their slogan, which they've been teaching Bristolians to shout out to. And we speak to Bristol students Phoenix and Molly. Plus the latest in our Super Brains series, one of my favourites. He's the shortwave US radio host and former US Naval Intelligence Officer, Bill Cooper. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM, Tuesdays at noon. This week, Earl Jesse. He was abused as a child, but he went on to become a high-rolling dealer of hard drugs. Great. In the villages of Berkshire, he tells his story of how the criminal life then sucked him in and his journey to rehabilitation. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday to that, or download it right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But former Conservative MP Harvey Proctor, who was convicted of gross indecency back in 1987, says he wants an investigation into the Metropolitan Police, who he says misled a judge. He stormed out of a TV interview earlier this week because he said impertinent questions were being asked and he wasn't being listened to. So I hope I'm joined on the line now by David Henke. Hi, David. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Oh, hello. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine, David. Yes. So I understand you've worked with Kevin in the past on the old Exaro News, or at least had some sort of connection. But can you just tell us, as a journalist, how did you first come to these child abuse allegation stories?
Well, actually, the child abuse allegation story came to me when someone who was in a dispute with the London Borough of Richmond came across information about a rather notorious bed and breakfast place called Elm Guest House, where it was alleged, it worked on two levels. One, it was in the 1980s, at a time when being gay, people kept quiet about it, and that was perfectly consensual. But it was also suggested that children were taken there. And basically my source sort of spent quite a bit of time digging around, and I started digging around about people who lived in the same road as where Elm Guest House was. And they, basically one or two of them, although they were a bit worried about seeing it, they took quite a lot of tracing back, because we're talking about 20 or 30 years ago, but we managed to trace some who alleged that they had seen children being taken there, and also alleged that were people rolled up in posh cars and were also using the place. And that's how I really started getting involved in investigating this. And it was it grew up from there. And following sort of inquiries were made, became rather clear that a local children's home called in Grafton Close, long closed, basically that there was suspicion that some of the children had come from there. The police launched not Operation Midland, but Operation Fernbridge, and basically discovered that the person who ran the home was charged with a number of offences. And they discovered a priest who was now based in Norwich, of all places, a Roman Catholic priest, who was his friend, was also charged with a number of cases. And it was a successful conclusion because the priest was put away for 3 years. And what they found was that the main person who ran it died 2 weeks before he was due to appear at Southwark Crown Court and the trial to begin. But it came out afterwards that the man was a convicted paedophile who, once he left Richmond, was actually caught in Kent on similar offences. And the court were told about how people were taken to actually Bexhill-on-Sea. And also, there were, unfortunately, because the guy died, a charge couldn't be pursued that he was taking people to Elm Guest House. But nevertheless, what was disclosed was that the London Borough of Richmond's children's home at that time, that there were quite a number of children who were actually basically considerably at risk, and some of them had actually been either sexually abused or pursued by these people.
Now, I mean, so many questions there, crikey, yeah, a bit of a baptism of fire, but there's so many questions there, it's almost difficult to know where to start, but there was, I know, a list apparently produced about Elm Guest House, nobody ever said that this was a definitive list, it included many allegations of all sorts of people who'd gone backwards and forwards. Do you think there was actually any point in creating such a list when no one could ever be really sure how accurate it was?
Well, this is the trouble. And actually, what was quite interesting about all this is that it was alleged to have been written or obtained by a woman called Carol Kazir, who was the joint owner of this rather disreputable bed and breakfast place, and which she ran with her husband. And the police at one stage arrested the husband, but he refused to cooperate in any shape or form, and basically they then released him and couldn't pursue this much further. But what was discovered, and I think partly in this, is there were some police officers on it, and it turned out that the police were trying to stake it out. And then there was a horrendous situation when they raided the place, but they only found one child there who was taken into care. The suspicion is that, I mean, he's now dead. The man who ran Grafton, they had contacted the man who ran this children's home because it was the nearest to where Elm Guest House was, and alerted him that they might need it as a place of safety. What the police had done was actually alerted a paedophile that actually they were going to be raiding Elm Guest House, and I suspect the whole thing was covered up. I mean, the list is very, very, very difficult to know whether it was true or not, and this has been one of the sort of mysteries that's still not certain about who did use this house. There was another rather extraordinary thing, was when a separate investigation by dispatches into Cyril Smith asked the Met Police a whole series of questions, and the only thing the police confirmed was that this is Cyril Smith had visited Elm Guest House. And I thought they wouldn't have actually told a media organisation that was the case unless they had firm proof.
How sure have you been? I mean, you know, basic journalistic techniques of making sure you're standing stories up. This is not going to be an easy task as a journalist to do this kind of case. What sort of problems have you had over the years of looking into Elm Guest House and around this whole topic?
We have a lot of problems, actually. I mean, for a start, actually, if you were going to interview survivors and others, they have been damaged, actually, by their experience. So it's quite and also, I mean, allegations against cabinet ministers coming from survivors. Most people can't recognise, wouldn't know who was in the cabinet. If you think of the general public today, probably couldn't name the government's cabinet, let alone a 7-year-old or a 9-year-old. And so basically, if you do this, you try and actually get evidence from people who are not abused, but have been witnesses to things like chasing people who were in the road where this place was, talking to my original source on what he had uncovered at the time, and try and build up a picture that will stand up information around it. And occasionally you get someone who, I did have in one case of Elm Guest House, it was luckily he was never taken there, but he basically escaped by the skin of his teeth from being abused because his social worker spotted something was going on there and got him out. But you can only build this up by actually quite a lot of work, and you actually have the problem is, and this is the real core of the problem, the child sexual abuse, people go to great lengths who are involved to cover it up. They go to great lengths to basically try to prevent anyone really finding out, and they also, when faced with anything, completely deny it. And sometimes, actually, when there are other people, the other people who deny it are often their family, because they don't really wish to believe this, actually. The interesting case at the moment is, if you remember, about Greville Janner, which is a whole separate issue, where there will eventually be some sort of inquiry by the Independent Child Sex Abuse Inquiry. All his family say it's all lies and so on, yet up to 30 people have alleged abuse. And also Henriquez, who after all is in the centre over criticising the Westminster paedophile ring, the way the police handled it and everything else, actually produced a report that is conveniently forgotten, where he said actually he thought when he reviewed things that Janner should have been, they should have actually raided Janner's house and arrested him about 5 years or so before he came to the attention of it. And actually, you just have to try and piece together all this different information.
What about the recent conviction, David, of Carl Beach? A lot of people have pointed to an extraordinarily long sentence that he's got.
Yes, that's. I mean, Carl Beach. I mean, appeared on the surface to be, you know, a rare case of, because a lot of the abused people are not. Without being too sort of dismissive of them, are not particularly well. Many of them are not well educated, and not and I think the police thought that they had got someone who was articulate, who made a lot of really strong allegations, and. And they've come under criticism. And I must say, the one thing I think they should have done very early on, which now the Met Police admit they don't, is actually basically taken his computer away. I mean, this is the problem for journalists investigating this. I didn't do the story at all, but a colleague of mine couldn't turn round to Carl Beach and say, I demand your computer and I want to go through it all, because he'd just say no. Only the police can do something like that. And I think because it involves so many prominent people, and because actually, frankly, the trial, he never produced any corroborative evidence. I mean, that was, I thought, extraordinary about it. I have a feeling that the general establishment thought, well, this was so grotesque in their view that that basically that's why he got such a long sentence. But he did get a proper jury trial and everything else on it. So,
David, what do you make of the
a very seriously damaged person, because certainly the allegations that have led to this furore when they discovered he had made up other people and other things like that, sort of led to a very sort of stern view about the whole thing.
Well, there's been
I don't think he helped himself by fleeing the country and hiding away in Sweden.
Well, I think the thing is, you've got damaged people, haven't you?
And I think this all went against him, which is why there's such a heavy sentence.
So what do you make of the police's role here? Have they simply believed someone they should never have believed? Because the thing is, the message goes out, doesn't it, to survivors is, you know, you could end up like Carl Beach.
Yeah, this is the most damaging thing of the lot, because there's a great argument about whether the police should believe someone making allegations like this. The answer probably to that is that the police should listen to all this and should follow it up. And I notice even Henriquez, who is the most savagely critical of the Metropolitan Police and the way they obtain warrants and other things, actually does say in his report, when you read it, that if Scotland Yard has actually said, once they had this Carl Beach thing, oh, we're not in there, they're important people, you've alleged three kids were killed and all that, and there were murders as well as all that, and we're not going to listen to you at all or take any notice of it, they would have been in severe trouble the other way around for it being said, well, someone had come and made really serious allegations to the Met Police and no one had taken any notice of it. And the real danger in this is, and I mean, and this is a danger by paedophiles and people who frankly believe that a lot of the child sexual abuse stuff is made up, is there's quite a lot of pressure for them to say, well, one, the police shouldn't believe them. Two, we should end up, if the police can't prove their allegations, and I've seen this on some of the wilder sort of websites, people saying, oh, well, they should immediately be prosecuted for perversion of the course of justice and put in prison. Well, actually, if you have that attitude, it's very convenient for paedophiles. If I come back to what I said before, it's done in secret, it's difficult to prove, and often you have to get outside people. And basically, it would mean no one would dare go to the police and make an allegation, because they'd be worried they were going to be locked up if the police couldn't prove it. Because the police can't always prove it all the time. And I would say, actually, the interesting thing about the West, although the press has concentrated a lot on the Westminster paedophile ring, if you look at North Wales, where there were allegations dating from about the same time, and if you remember, Gordon Anglesey, what was a chief superintendent, was accused of being involved in this and sued Private Eye successfully for suggesting it. Because the National Criminal, the NCA agency, did a thorough job on it, he ended up being a jury convicting him, and other main people who ran homes in North Wales have ended up behind bars. And this is 30 or 40 years later, and that is not really much covered by the national press, because it's actually been an incredible success. It's exact opposite to the Westminster thing, that people have come forward and the same allegations have been made. I mean, people have, the kids who've made these are now grown, well-grown men, you know, years afterwards, or immediately accused of lying, making it up, wanting money and all that. But in these cases, it's gone to the courts, and frankly, they've had a really good record of arresting people for historic child sexual abuse. And this is somehow glossed over at the moment.
Well, there's another enormous problem, David, and that is that it's the Crown Prosecution Service that brings these criminal prosecutions against these people, and yet we've seen some very close connections with the royals of both Jimmy Savile and a chap called Bishop Peter Ball. So it does make you wonder just how close this does come to the very top of the establishment, some of the cover-up.
Well, the Bishop Ball thing is really interesting, because he got away with it. And when you read the report by the Independent Inquiry into this, it was only really the Sussex police, because nobody really believed it. And it also is a brilliant illustration of how paedophile's work, because what he did was, I mean, the Church of England has got a lot of antiquated structures, and also people at the top, you know, going right up to the Archbishop of Canterbury. He created a sort of monastic order that wasn't really quite under the control of the Church, where, with a group of other people who then were involved in, frankly, in paedophilia. And as a result, this was fairly hidden, and it was only really the forensic work of Sussex Police that finally got him. And he had managed in between to convince the Archbishop of Canterbury, Prince Charles, and other people, Prince Charles even, you know, made a duchy a cottage available to him so he could live. And all these people, basically got away with it because he was quite a sort of prominent figure, and at the same time sort of live figure, that nobody believed it. And this is the danger of the whole thing. That, I mean, some people make out that, you know, paedophiles, well, they're all, they might be teachers, social workers, priests and others, but of course nobody important would ever be a paedophile. And this turns out to be, you know, I mean, we can think of the number of cases, and even among MPs, I don't think there'd be anyone who would say that Sir Cyril Smith wasn't a paedophile who got away with it through his whole career.
One of the most litigious and most virulent people are having a go at the police recently, saying that they have done far too much for survivors and not enough for so-called paedophiles, who he says are not paedophiles, is Harvey Proctor. How does he fit into all this? Because I know back in the 1980s he was actually a convicted sex offender himself.
Yes, I mean, I was in Parliament in the 80s, just around this period of 87, and certainly he was to an extent, he was actually privately quite notorious. I mean, after he was convicted, I mean, he would argue these days, because they've lowered the age of consent, it wouldn't apply. But he actually lost his parliamentary seat over the whole business. I mean, he now says, you know, well, I mean, if you go back to Carl Beach, we have to say that, you know, that the allegations are decided by court to be false, and he's now making a great big thing about the whole thing, saying the way he was treated and everything else. But what I think I would say about it is, it was certainly in the 1980s, the practices, and I know of other MPs at the time, and one of them who's dead now, basically, there were two problems, really. Basically, one, to be gay in 1987 is not like being gay in 2019, and a lot of them covered it all up. And there was one MP whose wife didn't know for 22 years that he was gay, and he only came out because he basically, she spotted a story about Justin Fashanu, the footballer, who basically was quite a conflicted guy. I suddenly realized that there was a story about him in the national press which talked about him having a connection with a South Coast MP, and the wife on that night suddenly realized that he had been he was leading a completely different life to the normal life. I mean, he had two children and everything else with her, and confronted him overnight, and he then admitted, yes, it was true. And Proctor fits into all this area where it was all hidden away. And certainly I have had, and I've not really been able to confirm a lot of this, but people have come forward with a lot of allegations about that period, suggesting there was much more going on in Parliament, involving, I would say, at least young men. They might now be over... They might now be okay, but at the time it would have been illegal, and MPs who were living double lives.
Let's have a listen now to Harvey Proctor, because he was on the TV earlier this week, and this is a programme where he was speaking to one of the presenters, and he decided that he didn't like what they were saying, their line of questioning, that he didn't feel that they were listening to him enough, and walked out of the studio. So let's have a listen to Harvey Proctor earlier this week.
By showing photographs to Mr. Beach of children that I'm supposed to have murdered, could have got in the way of any criminal action that was taken against me. Now, it's all right,
you talk across me, but that's because the BBC are very sensitive about any criticism
whatsoever that may come your way.
I will continue
by talking across me, you're not really doing what the BBC should do, and that is to give a right to comment. And you're very sensitive about this. I understand that. I understand the BBC is sensitive in view of the criticism that not just the police but the BBC has received in Henrique's report yesterday.
The IOPC has also found out there was no evidence regarding lying or deliberate wrongdoing by Cressida Dick, as you have just said. They also looked at the conduct. They also looked at. Please let me talk, and I will let you talk. This is how this works.
You've just said that the IOPC have found no evidence of Cressida Dick lying. Hold on. The IOPC have not interviewed Cressida Dick.
Okay.
They didn't know that she was involved. In fact, Sir Richard Henriques didn't know that she was involved. She wasn't interviewed by Sir Richard Henriques. Invite Cressida Dick onto your programme. Invite me onto the programme too, and let's have a debate about it. She won't come.
Sir Richard has also... I want to get to how this has impacted you, but I need to do my job as well and Sir Richard has criticised your work.
I respect your work very much, but you must not interview... You must not invite people onto your programme and then not allow them to speak.
I am allowing you to speak and I will allow you to speak.
You are
but
now,
I also
but you
need
weren't
to,
before.
I also need to give a right of reply rather than letting you say things that are potentially incorrect or when people don't have a right to reply.
I'm sorry, Richard.
Harvey Proctor, thank you for your time. Harvey Proctor, former Conservative MP, and I think what's made very clear there is the impact that this investigation has had on his life, as he said at the very beginning, how it's impacted on his life. Harvey Proctor talking to us this morning, former Conservative MP.
As he walks out of the studio, what do you make of incidents like that, David?
Well, I mean, he obviously feels, I would imagine what it is that he's not been, I mean, he was very much in the limelight in the 1980s and 90s, and he obviously got a job well away from Westminster and everything else, and then to find himself at the centre of an investigation. But the problem is that the police had to investigate this. I mean, if it was the other way round, and the police were given information by a person at the time, it was only proved later to be basically to have made up the stuff that he said, there would be a furore if it leaked out that the Met police were covering up allegations about children being murdered just because they were prominent people involved. And I mean, and I think the reason why the Met probably did pursue this at the time was that because if you go back to Savile, at the time people, you know, didn't believe it and everything else. And then, well, I mean, one's only got to look at the report by Dame Janet Smith, who did the report on the BBC stuff and what came out there, that basically people just turned a blind eye to it. And because he was Jimmy Savile and famous, they didn't do anything, or they didn't believe any of the people. And I think the police feel fairly badly that actually at the time, but this was, you know, that in fact people didn't get justice. So, I mean, I can well understand him being furious, I'm dragged into all this and the other. But on the other hand, the police did have a job to do. And if they covered it up, there would have been, the stories would all be the other way at the moment.
We've also seen, haven't we, since all this.
You know, if you were important, the nothing happened.
Yeah, so we've also seen since this the Jeffrey Epstein scandal, and I find it staggering that Ghislaine Maxwell, who clearly was a sex trafficker, seems to be still walking the streets. I mean, one wonders, doesn't one, when the police are looking at subjects like this, whether they, like some journalists, simply say this is too difficult to deal with, let's just walk away.
Well, because it's such a contentious subject, and because these people are wealthy, and I mean, I'm not particularly saying Harvey Proctor is, but I mean, basically have a lot of resources, and because of the libel laws and other things, I think actually probably journalists probably are very capable. And because it's a very difficult thing, if I come back to my original thing, to prove, because it's often done in private secret and they've gone to great lengths to cover things up, you are left with, you know, journalists can fail. I mean, in fact, I had some comments sent to me saying that, well, after the Carl Beach thing, journalists shouldn't cover anything that comes from sort of child abuse survivor. They shouldn't investigate at all unless the police are, you know, have investigated. They should just report what the decision is and just turn the people away. And I actually don't think that's right either, actually. I mean, because a lot of the people are, and it's coming out in the child sex appeal, the independent inquiry there, a lot of people, it does take quite a lot of courage for them to come out and talk about their experiences, and also because if it happens to them when they're very young, they often don't understand it at all.
Anyway, as it is such a difficult subject, David.
And also then they become damaged, then they get, or some of them get into crime and other things, so anybody, if they make any accusation, they say, oh well, he's just a criminal trying to make money. And this makes sort of an investigation actually quite difficult. But I don't think journalists should just forget about it and say, if someone comes to them, oh, sorry, no, if you're an abuse survivor, it's too difficult, we can't possibly look at it.
David, where can people find some decent information on this? Because it clearly is, I mean, there still seems to be some unexplained circumstances at Elm Guesthouse and elsewhere, and this is certainly not going to go away, particularly since this inquiry is going to be running on. Where's a good place to find out more about this? And maybe you can also plug your own website.
Yes, because I did one story, because it was always said that there was some suggestion that Carol Kazeo and that list and everything else, whether she just died normally, or whether actually there's more to it. And this is a good example of something. And then one of my sources discovered that, contrary to what was being said, at the hearing into her death, at the coroner's report, far from the papers not being there, they were there. And after a lot of badgering, managed to get them. And you then get little interesting pieces, like her GP had known her for 20 years, said she wasn't the sort of person to commit suicide, as suggested, and you sort of wonder. And also, we're also back, I mean, the establishment is still, I mean, I'm at the moment trying to work on a story about, there's been a recent new biography of Lord and Lady Mountbatten, which was written by a decent historian, Andrew Lowney, which goes into their whole life and also contains an interesting chapter about rumours about that not only was both of them have different lovers, but actually Lord Mountbatten was bisexual and even possibly alleged from one or two people a paedophile. Now, one of the connections is Kinkora, which is a notorious place in Belfast where various people were abused, and it's important people. And he was supposed to be released official information, which is still held in the National Archives, about the inquiry into it in 1985, correspondence and other things. And suddenly, the authorities wouldn't allow him under a Freedom of Information Act, because they said it was going to be published, then changed their mind. And the Northern Ireland Department is still sitting on stuff that goes back 40 years, and it's referred it to an advisory committee, but it means a further delay. And so to get and stand things up, you're not helped by a reticence of government to still thing to hide things, which is, and what are we talking about, 40 years, and we've got a 20-year rule now. They're still being held back.
Good God, I mean, it's amazing.
Whether it is because they don't want any
The cover-up continues.
They alleged there were investigations to important people.
The cover-up continues,
and it's
David.
It's extremely unfair to the victims.
Yeah, David.
Because they just don't get any justice or allowed to see the full paper.
David, the cover-up continues. Where do you think most headway may be made? Do you think through the criminal justice system or through the press? Because it seems to be that both of them are on the back foot at the moment.
They are, and I think we've gone through a period where, first of all, the time this actually happened, you know, the time, if you remember, it's not just the organisation I was working for, Exaro News, looking at this, but all the nationals were almost competing with each other for more amazing stories about, you know, child sex abuse involving prominent people in the wake of Savile and all that. And now they've gone the complete opposite way and saying, well, actually, all these are because of Carl Beach, all these allegations are probably untrue, and we're not going to touch it. And I think, unfortunately, we're probably going to go through a year or so before actually papers will come back and start raising issues. I mean, the good sign is that decent police forces are getting a lot of local coverage when they expose things. I mean, if one looks at the number of paedophile rings that they've been convicted, recently in Stoke-on-Trent. I mean, as well as the ones that are well known in Rotherham and places like that, and Newcastle and Hull, and that is getting local coverage, which is showing how serious is, and these people have been convicted, but very little national coverage because of the atmosphere at the moment saying, oh, you know, a lot of these things are probably untrue.
David, what's your website?
Right, thanks.
What's your website, please?
Oh, sorry, my website is Westminster Confidential, and it's at davidhenke.com, actually.
David Henke, thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show.
Well, thank you very much as well, and I hope it was useful. Okay.
Kevin Carhill's also here, who's worked with David. What do you make of that, Kevin?
David's always been... I've known David for about 40 years, not just since Exaro. David's always been one of the most sensible and careful journalists I've ever known. And if David thinks there is a smell, there is. And I hope the media follow him and follow what's still there.
What's your instinct on the question, the last one I asked him, about whether it will be the criminal justice system, the police, or whether it will be the press that makes progress on this issue? Because there's still a lot to uncover. As he's saying, there still things being kept secret which shouldn't be.
Yeah. Well, when all this was happening about 4 years, 3 years ago, I have a slightly different approach. I use documents, and a report was produced by a barrister and somebody from the NSPCC saying there were no hidden files. Well, a colleague of David's and mine, we went down to Kew, and it took us 1 hour to find 129 investigations into children's homes around London that had been sealed for 70 or 100 years. Again, that was never taken up. But there's a lot of stuff there.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, we've been hearing a lot on the international news and seeing a lot on TV about protests over in Hong Kong. The old, used to be a British colony, and was handed back to China in the 1990s with a long 50-year transition period, apparently. But things haven't been going too well there recently since the Prime Minister, or whatever she is, I'm sorry, I don't even know. Carrie Lam, anyway, let's call her just Carrie Lam, decided that she wanted to start a new law so that people who were convicted in Hong Kong could be extradited and tried in mainland China. Now, I'm joined by Phoenix and Molly from the university here. Hi, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
Phoenix, maybe we can start with you. Can you just tell us what Bristol Hong Kong students are thinking as they're looking at their TV screens?
I don't pretend to be a representative of all the Hong Kong people in Bristol, but my personal take is that protests have been becoming more and more violent every day, and it's all started with Carrie Lam, with the extradition bill, with her ignoring our peaceful protests. So, as you know, there was a million-strong protest, that like millions of people marching in peace, and after that, she tried to silence our voices with violence, and I think things just escalated from there on.
Molly, what's your take? What do you think when you're seeing these pictures coming over from Hong Kong?
It's really upsetting because I have always been proud of coming from Hong Kong. It's an international city, and I cannot believe the standard of police treating protesters right now. It's difficult to watch.
But it's also, if you compare it, say, for example, to the protests going on in London, it's quite a different level. It's actually much more extreme in Hong Kong. So obviously the police are going to have to use more extreme tactics to deal with it.
I don't think that is true, because the protests start out to be very peaceful. 2 million people took to the street in June, and still there wasn't any window broken except for a government building which was targeted by the protester. So it is very clear what the protester wants. The protest is very specifically trying to express our feelings towards the government, but the government is using forces to suppress us. So to protect ourselves, I think a lot of protesters has took to more extreme method, but the fact is we didn't start all this.
Well, no, but Phoenix, maybe you can explain, because there's a much bigger thing going on as well in the background, and that is a breaking down, slow breaking down of relations between the West and China. It's almost as if Hong Kong is caught in the middle of this.
Oh, yeah, I think that Hong Kong has become the last gate between China and the free world. As you know, there's been reports about major multinational companies bowing down to China because of opposing political views, like the NBA, for a recent example.
What's that?
So the NBA is the American Basketball Association, and the Rockets team GM, so general manager, Daryl Morey, he tweeted out something in support of Hong Kong, but then it got an extremely strong backlash from China, with the Chinese population saying that they're going to boycott the NBA.
I mean, isn't the idea that some place like Hong Kong can slowly transition from being a British colony to part of China? I mean, this was always almost bound to happen, wasn't it? That something was going to break at some point.
Yeah, but under the Sino-British Joint Declaration, we're promised to have 50 years of a high degree of autonomy. But obviously, China has been slowly eroding and taking away our basic freedoms. So we were also guaranteed to have genuine universal suffrage. But somehow, it's still not implied yet. And
well, hang on, because the British, the colonial power, you didn't have free, fair elections under that system either.
Yeah, but the Hong Kong's constitution, the basic law, we were guaranteed to be working towards that direction, and I don't see that happening anytime soon with that much Chinese interference in Hong Kong affairs.
So, Molly, what have you been doing here in Bristol? I mean, protest-wise.
So we had a protest last weekend in College Green. We were sent. We stand with some placards, and we had shout out some slogan. But the protests start out to be really peaceful, and we have young children joining us. We have people of all ages joining us. It's not just Hong Kongers. There are also Bristolian coming and show their support. People have been taking our leaflets. And we were there from 12 o'clock, and I think around maybe half to a group of Chinese people start standing in front of us and holding massive Chinese flag and trying to intimidate us.
Well, if you've got a Hong Kong flag, you can wave it back, can't you?
We do have plenty of flags, and they just keep calling people and trying to shout over us, and it is quite disruptive. It's as if they don't want us to talk about our issues.
I mean, for you, what is the big difference between Hong Kong and China?
The difference is quite apparent, because in Hong Kong we have, well, what we used to have is a high degree of autonomy, and we have free internet. We get to know about the world, and there is a very international population living in Hong Kong. And in China, things are censored, and they had patriotic education, which is quite different. So I think they probably have a different understanding to free speech. Like, for example, when we go out to protest, we try to express our feelings, and that is very common for us, whilst for them it's something very strange. And I don't think in a liberal society, people should be shouting over each other.
Well, I mean, I, as a part of the National Union of Journalists, we had some Chinese journalists come to Bristol. This is probably 10 years ago now. And I remember sitting thinking to myself, are these people really journalists? Because they don't really seem to have even the wish to question the authorities. There seem to be the sort of people who will just simply say what they are supposed to say. And there's a very, it does seem to seem, did seem to me a very different, but anyway, with, for you growing up, Molly, did you actually travel from Hong Kong into China much or at all? Your family just stay within Hong Kong?
I travel to China quite a lot, actually, because going across the border is not that far for us. And actually, my family, they are really patriotic, and we even went to the Beijing Olympic and we were holding Chinese flag. We were really proud. But I think what happened with the recent regime by Chairman Xi really changes China, like the introduction of the social credit system, the re-education camp in Xinjiang. And I just start to question what it mean to be a Chinese person, and what it mean to be from Hong Kong, and is that value crushing each other?
Phoenix, what about you? You travel much in China itself?
Yeah, I've been on several occasions because of how close the border is to Hong Kong. So I've been to several cities in China, the closest being Shenzhen, which is slowly becoming a mega city because China is trying to focus the economy in Shenzhen and also in Shanghai as well. So I've been there and everything is pretty advanced, but the air there is just bad. You can't even smell freedom there.
Well, I can tell you, I was actually interviewed for a job in Beijing. And I took one look at the air quality. You have to wear a mask the whole time. You can't even see your hand in front of your face quite a lot of the time. It's actually a bit of a health risk in some of these big Chinese cities. But at the end of the day, there needs to be some resolution to this. How do you think that can come in Hong Kong?
Well, at the rate of things are going, I don't think that there is any immediate solution, because as we can see on the news, on the internet, we see police being abusing their power and using extreme violence.
Well, hang on, because the case of the protester who was shot, he was actually attacking the police with an iron bar.
Actually, he was using a plastic stick. The iron bar was placed there. There is video evidence of this. The iron bar was placed there by the police officers after the boy was lying on the ground. There's evidence of this.
Well, we shall see. That may come to court. And also, it will be discussed in court. Also, the other point here is that Carrie Lam, if she was sitting here, would say, well, hang on, guys. You're protesting about the extradition law. I've now said that's gone. It's not coming back. It's gone. So why don't you just go back home and let's be friends?
Well, that's not true. She only made a promise to pass a motion through the Legislative Council. She could have just declared the bill be gone, but she chose not to directly express that, but rather to push it onto the Legislative Council. So I don't think that's a really responsible thing for the leader of a region to do. And obviously, all of us have better things to do, but our freedoms, our basic fundamental rights are being oppressed, if we don't come out and stand for ourselves, no one will.
Well, some people in some parts of the world are saying that the West is using Hong Kong as a stick to beat China.
Well, I mean, considering that China itself is a superpower, I don't think that media or even countries across the world are using Hong Kong as a stick to, let's say, beat China. We're just standing up for ourselves. So I don't think that there's anyone using us. Every one of us, we know what's important and what our fundamental values are.
I noticed some of the protesters even take their wills with them. They write a will and take it to the protests because they are prepared to die for what they believe in, which is, you don't really see that with Extinction Rebellion. Molly, can you just tell us about your group and how people can find you? And maybe if they want to come and visit you, when you're going to be around in the city centre?
Well, I have a message to Brazilian and UK listener. We want you to keep yourself informed about China's inhumane treatment to its people. Don't just look at it and walk away. Then we hope that you would vote with your money. Don't stop using Chinese product. Don't let Chinese censorship and surveillance get into your home.
Well, it's difficult to not use Chinese products nowadays. Everything seems to be made in China. Anyway, sorry.
I would say stop buying their phone would be a start. Stop using some of their social media would be a start. Finally, we want you to send with us. So our Instagram is Bristol_HK. And come and stand with us. We will have updates on next protests on Instagram, because by standing with Hong Kong, you're standing up for universal values. You're standing up for yourself.
Okay, and you wanted to do a little shout or something, which I imagine will be Cantonese or something. So you can do that now.
Oh, yeah. It's just a little message for our Hong Kong friends who are fighting back home. So, Hong Kong Yan, Gaio.
So what does that mean?
It means reclaim Hong Kong, and it's the revolution of our era.
Well, Molly and Phoenix, thank you very much for joining us this evening. It's a pleasure to have you here. More power to your elbow, folks, in keeping freedom alive. I just hope that has a peaceful and a sensible resolution. Kevin, what do you make of what's been going on over in Hong Kong?
Well, in the 80s and 90s, I used to spend a lot of time in Hong Kong, and I loved Hong Kong. It's sad to see China doing this. The Chinese system is becoming more authoritarian, and it's very sad. It also tells me that is a weakness. When regimes become authoritarian, it's not because they're strong, it's because they're weak.
Fascinating. Okay.
Very interesting.
So let's get on to, we've done things around the reverse order this week. The main news coming at the end, which is Iran. Not Iran, actually. No, it's Syria, isn't it? And things hotting up over there. What's your take on the what's been happening in northern Syria, the withdrawal of the US troops? Because it seems to me, Kevin, that Donald Trump is getting more and more annoyed with the impeachment proceedings, which he puts down to the Israel lobby. And he's now saying, well, we're going to get out of the Middle East. In fact, he did say that. What are we doing in the Middle East? The biggest mistake that the United States has ever made, and we're getting out of these endless wars. And that's what he's done.
I know nobody understands. I mean, his own American audience don't know if he's even able to think, because he talked about the Kurds not fighting in Normandy. I mean, 75 years ago.
But he also said the Kurds have been fighting Turkey for hundreds of years.
The Kurds, of course, that is partly true too, but that's another issue.
And the idea that the Americans can, from 7,000 miles away, come and sort that problem out, it's not going to happen. That's his point. Anyway, let's have a quick listen to Trump now.
This morning you cautioned Erdogan. Since then it appears as though there have been casualties on the Kurdish side. Are you concerned about escalation, and are you concerned that Erdogan will try to wipe out the Kurds?
I will wipe out his economy if that happens. I've already done it once with Pastor Brunson. I'm sure that I hope that he will act rationally. You do have to understand they've been fighting each other for many, many decades. Actually, for centuries, they've been fighting each other. And it was time for the Americans. We did a great job. We took care of ISIS. We captured 100%. You remember, I was thinking, John, of leaving at 97 and 96%. And that last 3 or 4% was the hardest part. And they told me it would take a year to 2 years to do it, and I did it in a month. Remember that? I flew to Iraq, and I met with a lot of great generals there, great generals. They said, sir, we can do it in 2 weeks to a month. And we did it in 2 weeks to a month, and we took it. And in the meantime, we've been watching over a lot with the Kurds, watching over a lot of prisoners, some very bad people. A few in particular very bad, really bad. And some of those people we've already taken, we've taken them out. They should go back, by the way. They should go back to Europe. Many of them came from Europe, but they should go back to Germany, to France, to, I spoke with Boris Johnson, a couple to UK, some to UK, actually, but they came from various parts of Europe. They didn't come from our country. And we did them a big favor, and we said to France, we said to Germany, we said to various countries in Europe, we'd like you to take your people back. Well, we don't want them. We don't want them. How about you taking them? I said, we don't want them either. Nobody wants them. They're bad, but somebody has to watch over them. I said, look, we did you a big favor. You take your people back. You take them back. They're citizens in many cases of those countries, of France, Germany. They didn't want to take them back. I gave them one chance. I gave them another chance. I gave them a third chance. And I even gave them a fourth chance. They didn't want to take them back. Not that I blame them too much. They're used to this with the United States, taking advantage of the United States, whether it's on trade or NATO, to take advantage of the United States. But we think that maybe the Kurds will do a job. And if not the Kurds, we think Turkey will do a job. But we have thousands of people, thousands. I don't know if you know that. We have thousands of captured fighters and thousands and tens of thousands of family members. And we did a big favor to a lot of countries, and those countries didn't want to take them back. So that's the way it goes. Steve?
Some of these ISIS fighters escape and pose a threat elsewhere.
Well, they're going to be escaping to Europe. That's where they want to go. They want to go back to their homes, but Europe didn't want them from us. We could have given it to them. They could have had trials. They could have done whatever they wanted. But as usual, it's not reciprocal. You know my favorite word, reciprocal. That's all I want. I don't want an edge. I just want reciprocal. And it's not reciprocal, Steve. It's not a fair deal for the United States. And when President Obama took the PKK, you know, when they bring in PKK, that's a tough deal because that's been a mortal enemy of Turkey. So when you bring them in into a partnership, it's a tough situation because it's tough for Turkey. It's probably tough for them. They've hated each other for many, many years, for hundreds of years. I mean, it's amazing when you look at history and you look at culture, but you look at the length of the time and the fighting for so long. So we imposed ourselves into it. And look, I've said it. I said it just yesterday. The single worst country, the United States, if you take a look at, you know, what we're doing with countries and the relationships we have with countries, but maybe putting it a different way, the worst mistake that the United States has ever made, in my opinion, was going into the Middle East. It's a quagmire. We are up to close to $8 trillion, and we're bringing our folks back home. We have great, talented military. We're bringing them back home. Our military has never been stronger, but we're now acting as police. We're policing areas. We're doing jobs that other countries should be doing. We're doing jobs, frankly, that Europe should be doing. We're doing jobs that Russia should be doing, that Iran should be doing, that Iraq, Turkey, Syria should be doing. They should be doing this. We shouldn't be doing it. We're 7,000 miles away.
Well, I'll put the whole of that on our podcast at thisweek.org.uk. Kevin, any final words on this? Because we've had a tanker attack too, haven't we?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like tit-for-tat retaliation, doesn't it?
Retaliating, you know, for what?
The Iranian attack on the Saudis' oil refineries. That attack showed how vulnerable a big oil installation is. The Saudis are now saying big Iranian ships are vulnerable too. It's horrible.
So it's this missile. These missiles came from the direction of Saudi Arabia. Is that, do you think, the Saudis or possibly special forces operating in Saudi Arabia? Maybe even ours, our own, our very own British Special Boat Service or something like that?
It could. I mean, the SBS and the SAS are employed by the Saudis, you know, with the consent of the British government. They could easily have been involved.
But okay. Well, time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, North Devon prospective parliamentary candidate for the Brexit Party, Dawn Westacott, Paul Hazeldon, Ben Ritchie, and Matthew Montague Pollock, as well as Roma Widger. So, you'll find this show's podcast, story links, and
many
show page.
Of those countries, of France, Germany.
This week.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'm off to Reigate beginning of next week. Our sister show Dialects here on Tuesday at noon. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Live from the Sky News Centre.